Today's episode of The Audible is brought to you by Trader Joe's, where the crew is on your team. Grab your shopping cart, make a quick snap, and move out of the pocket. Run an option to the demo station. Make an end around to the snacks. And then find an eligible receiver to take you to the end zone. Learn more at TraderJoe's.com and at Trader Joe's on Instagram.
Welcome back to The Audible. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by Stuart Mandel. Some interesting weeks of games we can talk about. We'll also have a great guest. It is Phil Savage. Nobody is plugged into Alabama better than he, longtime personnel man who now is part of the Alabama radio broadcast crew. We'll get to Phil in a little bit, but there's some flag planting and some interesting stuff we need to delve into, right, Stu?
We do. So how you doing? Are you having a better morning than Ohio State?
Ouch. I'm going to find out, Stu, because actually our crew is doing the Ohio State-Army game where Army comes in to the Shoe riding its first five-game winning streak in 21 years.
Let's just get right to it. Do you think I'm sure JT Barrett is going to be the starting quarterback against Army, but do you think we will see any of Dwayne Haskins for the Buckeyes?
Yes, Stu, I think we probably will see Dwayne Haskins, but I think if that's assuming as form holds that Ohio State opens it up in the second half, I don't think we'll see him injected into the offense in the first quarter. I think Urban Meyer is going to be very sensitive to not creating more of a problem. You know, if he puts in Dwayne Haskins and he goes down the field and hits three deep passes and they go 80 yards in three plays, then I think it just creates more of a swirl around what's going on with the offense. And I think he has, you know, this is a really challenging dynamic for him in terms of JT Barrett is the only three-time captain in the history of Ohio State football. They talk about how well-respected he is. The question is, and I think it's more than a JT Barrett thing, you know, because you still wonder about, are they the receivers? Are they running good routes? Have they developed? I mean, I think this is bigger than JT Barrett, but something clearly is not right. By the way, though, I think you can't put this all on JT Barrett. I mean, Baker Mayfield shredded those guys, and in a lot of ways, they were lucky it wasn't even a bigger blowout.
Very lucky, because Oklahoma, I believe, went cross midfield five times in the first half and came away with 3 points. So it could have been pretty ugly. Baker Mayfield on that played, you know, you wouldn't think at this point he could surprise you. He's obviously had such a distinguished career, but I would not have expected him to go in there and absolutely shred Ohio State's defense. We know how talented that defense is, though we also knew they were replacing three first round picks in the secondary, and it showed in the first half against Indiana, and it definitely showed on Saturday night.
Yeah, but keep in mind, you know what? Oklahoma's replacing the Biletnikoff Award winner, D.D. Westbrook, both Joe Mixon and Samaje Perine, and in the game, you know, their most proven receiver, Mark Andrews, was banged up. So, you know, give a ton of credit to Lincoln Riley. That was his first road trip as a head coach, and he thoroughly outcoached the guys on the other side of the field. I mean, he had a couple of interesting wrinkles, even the one where, you know, when Baker got knocked out of the game for a minute, that Kyler Murray came in. It was an interesting
Do you think he got knocked out of the game, or do you think that was part of the play?
You know, I don't know that. That's a good question.
I hate to be that guy, but it seemed like that was because then Baker Mayfield came back in. It was almost a designed run. Yeah,
it was almost like you're right. It was almost like an equipment, you know, violation where you just have to sit out one play.
Yeah.
But I mean, I thought it was, you know, you watch the highlights of that and you just see the middle of the field wide open, and they just exploited it. And I think so. Yeah, there were new guys at Ohio State, but there's a lot of new guys on the field at Oklahoma. You know, and I think that you look at, they have arguably the best offensive line in college football. They did not run it great, but they handled it. And I think, you know, what did you have for your high? Do you do a Heisman top five now?
The starting this week, the All-American is doing a Heisman straw poll of our staff. Okay. So I submitted a ballot for that.
And who is number one on your ballot right now?
Baker Mayfield.
Okay, same here.
Yeah.
I had some fans. I don't want to just say they were Louisville fans. I'm not sure. You know, it was like, well, you know, Richard Lego threw for almost 400 yards against them too. And, you know, even though they didn't win, I was like, first of all, to go into Columbus and do that, and you know, I'm not saying Ohio State wasn't, you know, ready for Deanna, but, you know, all eyes were on this game. And to do what he did, I think was really impressive. That's not to take anything away from Lamar Jackson, but, you know, right now Lamar Jackson hasn't faced somebody of the caliber of Ohio State on the road yet
either. He's about to, granted at home, but we'll get to that in a second. I just wanted to say, you know, so Ari Wasserman covers Ohio State for the Athletic's Cleveland site and wrote that from his vantage in the press box up above, Oklahoma's receivers were running wide open all night. Ohio State's receivers, conversely, could not get any separation. I do think Oklahoma's got some great DBs, but this continues to be a problem. And so to your original point about whether this can all be put on JT Barrett, no. But at this point, this regression has been going on for so long, and the 2014 season was so long ago, that I do think the storyline is legit. I don't think you just change quarterbacks without, you know, there's not a second guy here who has played. So to suggest that they would bench you, like you said, all-time off passing leader, three-time captain for a guy who hasn't played yet, that seems unlikely. But what if he struggles again in a big game? And then do you have to make that change? I don't know.
I think you cross that bridge at that point. Like, let's keep in mind that they lost around this time, they being Ohio State, you know, 3 years ago, and that team ended up winning a national title. Now, a lot of stuff had to happen.
And JT Barrett really struggled in that game, too.
He did. Now, it was way earlier in his development. I think the issue for a lot of Ohio State folks is going to be, well, he was a young quarterback then. Has he really progressed? And ultimately, is this a, you know, at some point, it can't be just, oh, well, he didn't mesh, you know, the staff he was working with wasn't Tom Herman last year, and now you have, you know, two guys who are very well regarded, Kevin Wilson and Ryan Day, you know, he's in their hands. And you know, ultimately, at some point, guys are what they are. And, you know, you can improve somewhat, but, you know, it's not like he's going to turn into, you know, he's not going to turn into Josh Rosen throwing the football. So, you know, I think one thing that I wondered about a little bit was, Dobbins, man, he looked fantastic when he gets the ball. And if, you know, I know Mike Weber's probably not 100%. He's still dealing with the hamstring issue, but I was a little surprised that, you know, JT Barrett ran it more than Dobbins did.
Seems to be a familiar Urban Meyer, no matter who the offensive coordinator is, when they are struggling, he just rides the quarterback as a runner more and more and more. And you know, adding to the subplot of that game, by the way, was the former Ohio State players tweeting about it, and Cardell Jones in particular. And at one point he made a reference, somebody suggested that he needed to go back. Obviously, he's going to defend his guy, JT. Somebody said, you know, we need you back. And he said, no, I'm not going to let Urban make me run the ball X number of times. There's a little bit of bitterness there, it seemed.
That is curious. I mean, we had a weird little social media circle, you know, in the last, I don't know, 5 days or so. I guess I felt like it started with, you know, the Urban Tom Herman stuff, you know, that Dennis Dodd reported on. And then there was just more layers to it. I honestly did not see a lot of the stuff on Twitter that, you know, apparently was out there. You know, the Cardale Jones thing. I thought there was somebody, maybe there was a recruit who popped off a little bit, an Ohio State commit, I think.
Here's what Cardale, first of all, you go in full circle. Cardale was always one of the funniest players on Twitter. And so as they're struggling during the game, he said, we need that magical pixie dust on offense right at about now, Coach Tom Herman. A reference to the quote after the Texas game that Urban kind of criticized. And then somebody said, we need you, not Barrett. And he said, no, they don't. Urban ain't about to run me to death. So that's what was going on that night.
Yeah.
I think you're right, by the way. Everybody's going to panic in Columbus, I understand. But it is the second game of the season. And we've seen this time and again where, you know, Oklahoma did this last year. They obviously, everybody jumped off that bandwagon after both the Houston and the Ohio State losses, and they ended up not losing again the rest of the season. Teams get better.
Question for you. This is as self-indulgent as I'll ever get on this thing, I think. Would you be more inclined now to watch our broadcast of the Army game this Saturday afternoon in the wake of what happened to Ohio State now that they're not a top five team? Or would you been, hey, they're number two in the country. I know, you know, Army's 2-0, but, you know, it's still a long ways away.
Well, what else is on in that time slot? No, I'm just kidding. If they had won comfortably, you know, nothing eventful happened against Oklahoma, no offense, probably not watching that game. But yes.
Now you're a little more curious, aren't you?
Now I'm a little more curious. I want to see how they come out. So you might have a pretty decent audience for that game.
Well, we're going to have a decent audience anyway because Ohio State has a massive following, thank God. And that'll be good. But I do think there's a little more intrigue into it and just how they respond to this, you know, in the face of it.
Your competition in that window is Tennessee, Florida, Notre Dame, BC, Wisconsin, BYU, Purdue, Missouri. Yeah, okay.
I feel pretty good about that. I mean, BC's offense is dreadful. Notre Dame has a huge, you know, following. We'll see how things, you know, what happens. Obviously, there's, you know, bigger issues in the state of Florida right now coming out of Irma as it, you know, has worked its way up there.
Speaking of, wait a minute. That game is in Gainesville, huh?
Yes.
Are they going to be able to play that game?
We'll see. I don't know. I mean, remember, Miami, Florida State was supposed to be this weekend, too.
Right.
So
they went and preemptively canceled that, but that was easy to make up because they both had that October 7th date. I don't know. Our friend Andy Staples lives in Gainesville and tweeted this morning that he was okay, his family's okay, but power's out, probably will be for a little while. So just the logistics involved there, we're going to have to keep an eye on that this week.
Yeah, and as we said, there's, you know, there's more important things with than football, obviously. But and with hurricanes, I've had family members down there who've been without power. And I remember when Wilma came through there, I guess it was like a dozen years ago, my sister was without power for like 20 days. So those can be big issues, and obviously resources get really stressed on that. So
we mentioned Notre Dame, BC.
Did you watch a lot of the Notre Dame-Georgia game?
As much as is possible when you're switching between four games. That was, I don't know how you did it. I at least had the two going at once with the picture-in-picture, but and it really helped, and one of them was at halftime. I would say I watched Ohio State-Oklahoma the closest, followed by
USC-Stanford,
but that got a little out of hand, so then you could kind of tune out on that, followed by Notre Dame-Georgia. Clemson-Auburn was probably fourth. Although I saw a lot of that early on because of it started first. What did you make of Notre Dame-Georgia? I thought that there was really no shame in Notre Dame losing by 1 point to a team that's expected to win the SEC East and has an absolutely dominant defense. And I thought, and I wrote about this, though, that Brian Kelly made it worse when he got into a snippy exchange with our friend Lakin Littman from the Indianapolis Star over a really innocent and frankly justified question about is this team going to be different? Because this was yet another loss by one possession, though he was very adamant that 1 point is different than one possession.
Yeah, it was a bizarre kind of thing on that. I got to admit, that game I did not see a ton of. By the time we got back from our game, it was already about halftime at the of some of those games. Not the USC game was had a later start, but or at least was going later. But so I didn't see a ton of that game. And I forgot, I must have been watching the late game, the Wazoo Boise State game. And I saw some people tweeting about it. And I was like, does this happen tonight? I mean, this is like, this. I thought, what happened? I thought we had this whole, you know, Zen Brian Kelly,
yeah,
yoga,
different coach,
and all this stuff. And it's like literally, you know, a week and a half into the season, 2 weeks into the season, and here we are again. And I felt like actually that was a more, I was trying to think about it, like Brian Kelly's obviously gets caught in, you know, the purple face Brian Kelly on the sidelines, you know, sometimes going off on players. And I think some of his answers at press conferences have probably could have been worded better. But this is the first time I remember seeing him have like a back and forth with a reporter like that. Do you remember an exchange that he's ever had with anybody like that before?
It's hard to say. I don't think so.
So then the answer is no. You don't remember?
No, nothing like that. I mean, that went on and on and on. And No, I don't. I mean, first of all, one of the things Brian Kelly is known for is being really gregarious with the media. So I think, I don't know, I guess he was really, really adamant to make sure this didn't go back down that road this year after the debacle that was last year. But that seemed a little extreme.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how they respond. I mean, I think they'll handle BC. I don't think BC is particularly good. But, you know, again, in the face of the, you know, probably to his credit, I think he had taken a lot of the blame and kind of seemed like he at times went out of his way to make sure he took the blame for last year. But then to, you know, kind of go this direction, I just think that people are like, wait a minute.
Well, it wasn't him blaming the players like he's often known for doing. It wasn't that. But it kind of fell into that same category of, you know, I feel like he compounds the losses sometimes with his post-game comments. You know, I think Notre Dame looks like they're pretty good on defense now, or at least much improved from last year. And, but, you know, their offensive line got worked by Georgia. I don't know that we even really saw how good a quarterback or not Brandon Wimbush can be, because he didn't have any time to throw and they really couldn't run the ball. But I think Georgia's going to do that to a lot of people. That's a loaded front seven. I think they're going to do that to a lot of people this year.
Let's talk about the Dogs for a second. So Jake Fromm, solid first road start. They get a win.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like my sleeper in that division is South Carolina?
Yeah.
And I don't feel bad about throwing that out, you know, a couple of weeks ago now. Where do you stand on the Dogs? Do you think they're a legit? We're waiting to see who's the second best team in the SEC after Alabama. Do you think it's Georgia?
I think it could be Georgia, though the true freshman quarterback element still makes me a little bit nervous.
Do you feel much more comfortable with it with a second-year sophomore who, you know, there's no slam dunks on what he's going to do?
I don't know. I think people were quick to dismiss Jacob Eason. Any true freshman quarterback is going to struggle the way he did. I was eager to see how much improvement he would make into his sophomore year. We just never got that chance. He got hurt right away. So the true freshman quarterback element makes me a little nervous. But also, you know, I agree with you. South Carolina off to a great start. Definitely a dark horse candidate, but I think Georgia's probably still more talented top to bottom in the East. And then in the West, I'm curious for LSU-Mississippi State this week. That's an under-the-radar game a little bit, where we're going to get a good read on both those teams, but in particular LSU, who, if you're saying who's the second-best team, I think I saw you have them in your top 10.
I did. Look, they started five freshmen, and BYU didn't even get to midfield. You know, that was a dominant performance. BYU is
BYU's
not a bad
issues.
Yeah, but they're not a terrible team.
They might be this year. Took them a long time to score that first touchdown.
Yeah, I still don't think BYU. Like, I think BYU is not like it's not an FCS team. If you stuck BYU in, you know, a non-Power 5 league, they would be one of the best teams in it.
I'm trying to tell you that in general that's true, but they look like they are bad this year.
I mean, they have a quarterback who's played a lot of football, who's a good quarterback. You know, they lose to Utah. It's not like Utah is terrible still.
If you had to guess, where do you think BYU ranks out of 130 teams in scoring offense?
They're low. I mean, but they play.
How low?
They're probably like in the high 100s, like 110, somewhere between 110 and 120.
125.
Okay. Well, they played LSU. And they played Utah. Those are two really good defenses.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first game?
Who did they play, like Presbyterian or somebody?
Somebody like that. They won, but the offense didn't look good then. They got some serious issues on offense. That being said, you may be right about LSU. We'll see. They play Nick Fitzgerald and Mississippi State this week. I think that'll be a good test for them.
And they may get their best defensive player back. My hunch is you may see some Arden Key this week. So,
that'd be good.
Let me ask you the team that a lot of people were pushing as a legit top 10 team, and they did not look good, especially in the second half on offense, and that's Auburn. Less than 200 yards of total offense, 14 tackles for loss, 11 sacks. Jarrett Stidham, you know, he was a dark horse Heisman guy for a lot of people. What do you make of that?
So our guy Tom Luganville, who's doing scouting reports for the All-American, pretty much nailed that. He watched the tape of Auburn's first game and he said their tackles really struggled, and he thought they're going to be in trouble against that great Clemson defensive line. And yeah, they got absolutely dominated. That's a problem because everybody was looking to Jarrett Stidham to be their savior. But if they can't protect Jarrett Stidham, what good is that going to do?
Where do you think Auburn's going to go from here after that kind of showing?
Well, they might not play a better – in fact, they will not play a better defense than that until the Iron Bowl. So I don't want to really completely panic about Auburn yet. If anything, that showed you that, you know, Clemson won a national championship last season and is probably – on a whole other level defensively than they've even been so far under Dabo Swinney. When you've got Austin Bryant, Dexter Lawrence, Christian Wilkins, Dorian O'Dane, like that defense is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a terrific defense, no question.
Hey, let me dip into, we don't get to do this very often anymore, but I did open our, you know, the audiblepod@gmail.com, and James Birdsong kind of asks the flip side of what you're saying. Guys, I think not enough has been said about Clemson's performance against Auburn on offense. Clemson's offensive total is 185 yards passing, 99 yards rushing against the top 25 defense. However, I don't think Kevin Steele's defense is so stout to limit Clemson to just 14 points total. And Clemson's running backs, none of them were able to rush for more than 17 yards. Do you share similar concerns heading into their first true road game at Louisville?
So, yeah, some, because look, I thought Clemson would not probably be a top five team, would be maybe a top 10 team, but I thought they were going to take a step back because no Deshaun Watson on the offense. They lost some really good offensive players and one great offensive player. So I don't think that's shocking. Now, I don't think Louisville has a great defense either, but looking at them, I think there's going to be concerns. You know, to me, they'll be good on offense, but I don't think they'll be great on offense.
No, and you know, Deshaun Watson, obviously that's the biggest question, but losing him, but they also lost Wayne Gallman, a pretty good running back.
He breaks like a tackle breaking machine. Yeah, I mean, it just grinds you out.
None of their guys that are back have been all that impressive. So they're gonna need to score probably considerably more than 14 points against Louisville. But at the same token, as great as Lamar Jackson has been so far, and he has been every bit what you remembered from early last season and more, you know, what was the issue? What was their downfall toward the end of last season? Pass protection. Now you're playing a team that just had 11 sacks against Auburn. I'm fascinated to see. It was a great game last year in Clemson. I was there. This matchup is particularly fascinating.
So the stage is set for Lamar to go, hey, you guys in the media who were regretting voting me first for the Heisman and all the people writing me off, you see what happened with Stidham? You guys loved him. Now watch what I do to these guys. You think Lamar comes out of here with like such an awesome performance?
Well, I think it could
have to rethink it.
It could go either way. He comes out and has an awesome performance, and it's right back to, you know, commanding Heisman lead like he was last year. Or they shut him down, and that's it. No more repeat Heisman chances, because now people feel like, well, we gave him a second chance, and he couldn't do it again against a really good opponent.
I got to admit, like what happened last week with the Auburn Clemson game sets this up really well for Lamar to, because Lamar's been awesome the first 2 weeks, but it's like, okay, you know, North Carolina lost to Cal. So it's, you know, you kind of want to see him on a bigger stage again.
It's interesting that people forget that last year, if you want to play who did he do it against game?
He did great against Clemson and Florida State.
Yeah. Know. Yeah, exactly. I mean, not Houston and not LSU, but it wasn't like he racked up all of those numbers against nobody. In fact, the turning point in the season was that Clemson game last year where they lost. And in coming out of it, it seemed like he strengthened his lead in the Heisman race. Now, there's been a lot of great, you know, you and I do these we talked earlier about these Heisman ballots. I had Baker Mayfield 1, Lamar 2. Guess who I had 3?
Let me think. Saquon Barkley.
No.
Well, you're an idiot.
What do you mean? That's it? He's a great player, but.
Mason Rudolph?
No. Ed Josh. Oliver.
He's back. Yeah. Oh, I appreciate you sticking him in there. I mean, look.
Did you see what he did against Arizona?
I saw a little bit.
11 tackles, a forced fumble, a blocked kick, a couple tackles for loss. Now, the guy was a first-team All-American as a true freshman, people are going to try to – people might forget about him because he plays for Houston. That game was certainly not well watched. But, I mean, the guy may well be the best player in the country.
He may. Look, Derwin James may well be the best player in the country too. You know, it's good. I think Saquon is, but that's okay. I appreciate you sticking him in there. Who else was – who are your other two guys who were 4 and 5?
Oh, we just did top three. Who'd you have?
I had Barkley 3. I had Mason Rudolph 4. And I had Rosen 5. I was tempted to put Darnold in there. And I was like, can I put a guy in there as a 4-4 TD to interception ratio so far? So I know
how eye-opening,
there's a chance.
Yeah, how eye-opening was that USC offensive performance against Stanford in that it wasn't just Darnold. They ran for over 300 yards as well. That doesn't happen very often that somebody runs for 300 yards on Stanford. And especially given that running the ball has not been USC's strength the last few years, and now it appears they have an absolutely fantastic 1-2 tandem.
Yeah, I think one of the best hires USC has made in a while was DeLion McCullough, who had been produced some really good running backs at Indiana and came in here. And I think Ronald Jones, I don't know if I would put Ronald Jones as a sleeper Heisman guy, but I think he's going to have a huge year. And Stephen Carr is really explosive, and you're seeing that. I want to go back to something. You and I were a little differing coming in on Stanford this year. I wasn't that shocked by that. I don't think Stanford is close to the top two teams in the Pac-12 right now. Don't see it.
Well, I was shocked by the defensive performance. You know, Keller Christ and the passing game was the biggest question coming in, and they didn't do anything to quiet that against USC. Bryce Love obviously had a good game. But no, I don't expect – I thought their defense could be really good. I didn't expect USC to do that to them. We'll see if that was more USC. In fact, Stanford turns around this week and plays at San Diego State, which is not a gimme by any means.
No, they're running back. Their running back, you know, may have had as big a week as anybody not named Baker Mayfield. Scored, you know, 3 touchdowns every way imaginable.
Rashad Penny.
Penny, yeah.
Touchdown running, touchdown receiving, and a 99-yard kick return.
What percent chance do you give Tom Herman 6-0 against top 25 teams of coming out to L.A. and knocking off USC?
8%.
Eight. Okay. That's not terrible.
What? It's 8%. What is your...
No. Mine was going to be 15%. Yeah. 8% is not like...
Not liking their chances. Now, doesn't mean that they're bad, you know. But, I mean, we're not sure what's going on at quarterback. Are they going to start the true freshman? Are they going to start Bouchel? I don't know. How can you have any confidence that defense is going to be able to contain USC?
I'm not sure I do have a ton of confidence that they're going to do that. I could see Tom Herman, and, you know, he's very good with game plans and everything else. I could see them finding some issues with USC and keeping it interesting into the second half. Maybe lose a 42-24, 28 kind of game.
Sure.
But where USC kind of takes or really, you know, shuts them down in the fourth quarter, but it's a game in the third quarter.
Yeah, no, I mean, don't be surprised if it's a good game. It's just it's a shame that it's not. You know, if Texas hadn't lost to Maryland, this would be everybody's game of the week, and then maybe it would end up being lopsided anyway. But just the context, obviously, of this is the first time they've played since the great 2006 Rose Bowl. And now I feel like it's just kind of – I feel like Clemson-Louisville is the only kind of headline game in week 3. But, of course, you say that and then crazy things will happen elsewhere.
Agreed. By the way, I want to throw this out there. Just seeing Oregon in person, the Ducks are like night and day compared to where they were last year. The energy around the team. We talk a lot about Sam Darnold and Luke Falk and Jake Browning and Josh Rosen. Don't at all be surprised if their quarterback becomes a first-round pick. I mean, Justin Herbert is really, really good.
Yeah, he really impressed me the other day, regardless of what poor condition the Nebraska defense may be in. But what happened at halftime of that game? It seemed like Oregon's offense just shut down for the rest of the game, and Nebraska almost pulled a Josh Rosen.
Yeah, I talked to Willie Taggart coming off the field, And I, you know, we talked about a few things, and then, you know, what are you going to tell him? And he said, don't lighten up, tighten up, keep going, keep going. Well, you know what? That's exactly what they did. They lightened up, and I don't know if it was just a young team and got a little too comfortable, but they throttled down. You know, Nebraska, it was cool to see Nebraska. I mean, their fans are awesome. They traveled well. That place got really loud, and I think eventually, you know, Oregon did make plays on defense to end it, but it was just – it's just like one team got into a rhythm and the other team just kind of forgot to play four quarters. They just didn't play in the third quarter. I mean, credit to Nebraska, but again, it's a really young Oregon team, and I still think they're figuring it out right now.
Tanner Lee, who Nebraska fans were pinning all their hopes on, was quite underwhelming in that performance.
Yeah, a couple of the picks were not on him, though. I think you see some stuff why people, like personnel people, are so intrigued by him, because his arm is really good and his release is good. You know, sometimes when you throw balls before the receivers turn around, you know, which is what, you know, a lot of people want to see from a, you know, in terms of anticipation, sometimes you look really good and sometimes you look really bad. And that happened definitely on Saturday. You know, I wouldn't judge him by the box score, though. I mean, you have to, you know, if you watch and see some of the things he does, you can see why they are very excited about him. Defensively, they looked awful in the first half, especially when you see, you know, Nebraska has, and that doesn't even include one of their best DBs is out for the year. They have like three guys who you look at physically and they're like, those guys are NFL players. And for them to have just been carved up the way they were, Justin Herbert, I think, was 21 of 25 in the first half. And this thought kept in my mind, like, they do not have a lot of depth at receiver. The one thing they really don't have is that big receiver, because they have, you know, Charles Nelson's really good, and Dylan Mitchell and Johnny Johnson's are, you know, really good young receivers. Darren Carrington was probably the best of the bunch. Now, he's at Utah, and they booted him off the team. If they still had him, I think they'd be so much more explosive, because just that having that big target is something they really don't have outside of their tight end.
Well, give a lot of credit to Willie Taggart for having them ready this early in his tenure. I'm in a bit of a funk with prognostications. I've been wrong about pretty much everything the first 2 weeks of this season.
Give me your three biggest whoops so far.
My three biggest whoops so far. Well, the other day, we picked the 10, what we consider the 10 biggest games on the All-American. One of them got canceled, UCF, so that leaves 9. And I went 2-7. Pretty much every swing game other than Clemson, I was on the wrong side of. I thought Oregon's defense was going to be so bad coming off last season that they would lose to Nebraska. I thought Stanford, as you mentioned, I was very high on Stanford, thought they could go in and beat USC. Which is, by the way, a reason why you shouldn't pick so many road teams. Although Oklahoma, obviously. Oh, well, my biggest whiff is Ohio State was my national champ. So,
yeah, I'll take the L on that one, too.
Yeah.
And I freaking saw them in person, saw Oklahoma, was really impressed by them, and still I couldn't pull the trigger. I thought they would play well, but, yeah, I got that one wrong. I'm with you on that.
I blame this on having not had a team or a player that misses all preseason camp. You know, we were busy launching the site, so I didn't really have a preseason. We launched on August 28th. I think it's affecting my ability to predict things.
That's a bad excuse still. I'm sorry.
Okay. We want to introduce a new feature real quick, a new segment, and that is
the shout out.
This is
a way to get in something that should be a little off the radar, to kind of give props to somebody or something in college football, and I will give you the floor. You go first.
No, I'd like you to go first, because the one I was going to do, we already ended up bringing up, so I have to think of a new one.
Aha, okay. My shout-out is going to be towards UTSA.
There you go.
The Roadrunners. Frank Wilson went to, you know, they beat Baylor. It is the third time. He's only been a head coach for a little over a year. It's the third time he has played an opponent that has been a 17-point favorite or more and has won the game outright. This is a big win. I mean, I think we talked about Frank a few weeks ago on the Audible as somebody who I would expect to get a much bigger job in the not-too-distant future, and I think this was a big step in that direction.
So I pretty much knew that was who you were going to pick. I just guessed that, because Frank Wilson was one of the stars of Meat Market.
Yeah, he was as impressive as a coach as I've been around, just in terms of how players respond to him. I'm not surprised he's having success. I'm not surprised he recruits well. You know, it's a shaky start for Matt Rhule. I think that, and if you're a Baylor fan and you've obviously, you know, been through some, you know, a rough go, I think the thing to keep in mind is this is probably going to get worse before it gets better. But I do think it's going to get better.
Speaking of that, and I will do my shout out in a second, but so I did think Baylor was going to be in for quite a rebuild, but not this. What the heck? How can you go from, you know, contending for Big 12 championships under Art Briles and starting 6-0 last year to losing to Liberty? And you, like, I thought they would be a sub 500 team. They might not win a game in the Big 12.
Yeah, Liberty one was the jolt to me. Like I said, I thought UTSA would be pretty good, but Liberty is definitely that's an ugly one. No doubt about it.
So is it a matter of attrition and all the guys have transferred out of there since that scandal?
I think it's some
Matt
of that.
Rhule is just not. He's just. I was, you know, concerned about it. Frankly, he comes from such a different background and brings such a different system than what they've been running there for so many years.
I definitely think there's adjustments. Obviously, he won big at Temple in a way that nobody had there, so he's a good coach. It's just, I think it's a big transition. You know, they started with Anu Solomon, the transfer from Arizona. Now they're going to go with Zach Smith, who played some last year at quarterback. And, you know, I think they'll win some games, but I think they could be, you know, they may be fortunate to win four games this year. The bottom of the Big 12, you know, Iowa State is much improved. Now Kansas had a clunker of a performance the other day, but you look and see there's, I think Texas Tech will be better. I don't think there's, you look around, Kansas is close to a, you know, as an easy one as you're going to get, but Iowa State's not an easy game, you know, so they're going to have to struggle to get to four wins, I think.
My shout out goes to a guy who, it's been a few years since you've seen him on the big stage, and that is Shane Morris. Shane Morris is remembered primarily for getting a concussion in a game for Michigan and Brady Hoke not pulling him out. He's at Central Michigan now. And on Saturday, they beat Kansas 45-27, and he threw for 467 yards and 5 touchdowns. How's that for a career resurrection?
That's pretty good for a respectful resurrection. You pulled that out of your back pocket. And I was, that's good stuff from you.
Well, thanks. You know, I do my research, and I pay close attention on Saturdays. Quick, close runner-up, Eastern Michigan. 0-58 against Power 5 teams until they went and won at Rutgers the other day. Speaking of bad predictions, that was one of my three locks of the week. Rutgers -5, and they lose at home to Eastern Michigan on a really bizarre ending. But hats off to Chris Creighton, who is – that program was about as bad as it gets for about 15 years. And he took them to a bowl game last year, and now they just beat their first Power 5 foe.
Yeah, and it was a rocky start. You know, the first couple of years, they really, really struggled. It looked like more of the same. And he's got it turned around, and you're right. I mean, he's a name that, you know, college fans should hear more about, and I'm glad you stepped up on the Maction front, Stu.
What do you say we get to our guest?
All right, and now we are joined by our guest, Phil Savage, longtime NFL personnel guru and former GM, and you can catch him on Sirius Radio. Also, though, the big reason why we want to have Phil on with us is he just had a book come out, Fourth and Goal Every Day, Alabama's Relentless Pursuit of Perfection. Phil is more plugged into Alabama than anybody in the media, in part because of his expertise and all things personnel, but also, and his relationship with Nick Saban. They go way back as guys who worked on the Belichick-Browns regime, but also he is one of the voices of Alabama radio during games. So, Phil, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Bruce. Thank you.
Let's start with your relationship with Nick Saban. Did it first start when you guys were together in Cleveland, or was it something from before there?
No, it started in March of 1991, and there's sort of a funny story behind it because I was actually working for Mike Riley and the San Antonio Riders of the old World League of American Football, and I get a call from the Browns that they want to interview me for one of their lower-level quality control coaching positions, so I take the interview, I end up getting the job, And so on March 18th, 1991, I walk into the building in Berea, Ohio. We were on the campus of Ball and Wallace College at that time. Bill Belichick walks in, introduces himself as the head coach. I had interviewed with the assistant coaches. And he says, hey, we're one short on defense, so you're going to be working for our defensive coordinator a lot, a guy by the name of Nick Saban. So Bill walks me around down the hall. I meet Nick, and literally in 5 minutes, my first 5 minutes of the NFL, I met the two greatest coaches of this generation.
Wow.
I've always been curious. I guess I've never asked you, how did you end up, obviously the connection is there, but you know, was there an interest? How did you end up getting into broadcasting and being on the color guy for their radio?
Wow. So that little story I told was from 1991. And so but previous to that, I'd been a grad assistant at Alabama in 87, 88, 89, when Bill Curry was the coach there. And then when he left and went to Kentucky, I followed Homer Smith to UCLA. And before I did that, though, Mal Moore was the offensive coordinator for Gene Stallings, who was coming in after Coach Curry. And so I stayed for about 6 weeks, sort of helped in the transition and got to be friendly with Coach Moore. We maintained that relationship through all these years as he, transitioned from coaching to obviously becoming the athletic director at Alabama. So now you spend all the way forward to the 2008 season. I was still the GM of the Browns, but for the Crimson Tide Sports Network, Kenny Staver, the Snake, had been the color analyst for about 10 years, but he had taken a leave of absence during that season. And so they had a substitute color man for every game in 2008, which I can't even imagine how difficult that must have been for Eli Gold. So at the end of the 08 season, I had gotten fired by the Browns as the GM. And in January of 09, I called Coach Moore and said, hey, I think I'd like to get my name in the hat on that radio position. I said, the problem is I think I could check off 11 of the 12 boxes that you're looking for, except for maybe the most important one. I didn't play at Alabama. I played at Suwannee. And he said, I'm not worried about that. He said, because, you know, you've been around here, you know our program, you know Coach Saban. He goes, that might not be a bad idea. And so I auditioned for the job in the spring of 09 for the A-Day game. A few weeks later, they called me back and said, you know, would you want to do it? And I said, yeah, I absolutely would want to do it, thinking it would probably be for one season. And here it is going into the ninth season. But when I got the job, I'll share the story with you guys. I called my mother to tell her that I'd gotten the position. And her response was, well, I hope you're good, because she goes, I hope you know what you're doing. You're going to be, and you'll be good, because I love listening to Snake. And I'm like, my own mother said that to me. I got a long way to go, but here we are 9 years into it, and it's been a heck of a ride for sure.
Let me ask you this. So the book is Fourth and Goal Every Day, and, you know, it comes from, as you explain in the book, basically the vibe around the program. It's fourth and goal every day here. So a lot of times, especially with people who are around a program, sometimes it's like you don't know what you don't know. Well, you've seen football at the highest level. How challenging, not just was it writing this book, but also during a broadcast where you want to provide insight, but you don't want to kind of give away too much, because all of a sudden then it's like you may be betraying the confidence or the relationship you have with Nick Saban and his staff.
Yeah, I've tried to be super sensitive to that, you know, through the years. And of course, with my role as the Reese's Senior Bowl executive director, it's important for me to keep a good relationship with everybody in college and pro football. So I've been very cognizant of that. In regards to the book, you know, in many ways, what really happened, Bruce, is Ray Gleer, the co-author, he called me after Bama had won the fourth title in 7 years after the first Clemson game. And said, you know, Sav, you grew up in the state. You were here as a child when Bear Bryant was dominating the scene in college football. So then you worked with Bill and Nick in the early 90s and were there sort of in the beginning of their formulation of their philosophy and approach to winning. And he said, now you've been back as a color man and you've seen all of this come to fruition. He said, you're the one person that could link all of these elements together, the culture of football in Alabama, why it is so important, why Nick Saban and his staff and the players have been so successful, the how and the why of that, and then just sort of a tribute to what you've really been an eyewitness to over the last decade. And so, you know, really a lot of it is just observations and putting two and two together and say, man, I remember when we were talking about this or going through this back with the original Browns in the early 90s, and now, you know, it's being applied to what Alabama's doing. And that's particularly true in what college people call recruiting. But see, to me, Alabama, they not only recruit, but they also evaluate. And that's a huge distinction in the college game. And certainly there's been a lot of people, a lot of coaches, a lot of analysts in terms of the player personnel staff that have come and gone from Alabama. So everybody, you know, knows a lot of what's in the book, but no one's really ever put it, I guess, in that form. But that really is sort of the essence of it. And it encapsulates really 30 years of being in the sport at the major college and or NFL level and sort of blending those two things, which is really two totally different games.
Phil, you and I talked right before the Florida State game, and, you know, I think in the first two games we've seen kind of in many ways what you would expect from an Alabama defense, obviously dominant. But, you know, we talked about how one of the big mysteries of this coming season was going to be Brian Daboll taking over as offensive coordinator. Much different background, obviously, than Lane Kiffin and Steve Sarkisian. Through two games, what's your assessment of the main way maybe he's putting his stamp on the offense?
Yeah, I would say that Brian Daboll has definitely been more direct. In other words, it's more of a meat and potatoes style of approach, more north and south runs, not nearly as much horizontal type action with the jet sweeps and all those sorts of things, although they still have a dose of it. I think the number one challenge, and I think the number one task for Brian, at least in my estimation, is Jalen Hurts is an outstanding dual threat quarterback. He learned to play a certain way, so to speak, in middle school and high school. And quite frankly, his first year in college, Bama sort of adapted their scheme to build around his skill set. But as the competition level got higher versus Washington, versus Clemson in the playoff, and those defenses were better, Bama found themselves in third and long situations because they were not as successful on first and second down, and they needed to be able to rely on Jalen Hurts as a pocket passer, and obviously that didn't go so well. And so, to me, that's the number one thing for Brian is to not transition Jalen away from being a dual threat quarterback. That's what he is. But to sort of try to complete the picture with him as a complete quarterback. And I think they've made some progress in that regard. It's going to be incremental. It's not going to just happen overnight. But that is, to me, that's the element of their offense, that if they can ultimately conquer the third and seven or more, where Jalen's comfortable in the pocket and can go from one receiver to the next, and maybe a third option and or take off and run, then there'll be a difficult offense to get your arms around because they will then have the flexibility of virtually being able to do most anything that you would want.
Phil, I had an interesting conversation. I did the Oregon-Nebraska game this past weekend and got to spend a bunch of time with Mario Cristobal. I had known Mario since we were in college together, and he was obviously on Nick Saban's staff for a while, and he had a couple of buddies from UM who happened to be visiting then. So it's kind of talking about like the great Miami teams and then the personnel he said, you know, Alabama has right now. And he said, it's just, you know, it's amazing how stacked that roster is, you know, and how well he's recruited there. The one question was, you know, this run of it, the quarterback play has been solid, but it's not like you look and go, since Nick has been there, I guess AJ McCarron probably would be the best quarterback in terms of NFL eyes, and he's basically a backup. Why do you think that there hasn't been that, you know, Tua Tagovailoa, I know, came in with a huge reputation, and we'll see how he develops, but why do you think there hasn't kind of been that prototype guy we see at maybe other schools, hasn't been there, you know, for this whole run there at quarterback?
I think part of it, Bruce, and I tried to contrast a little bit the success of both Bill Belichick at the pro level and Nick Saban at the college level. You know, a lot of people look at the Patriots and say it's the head coach and the quarterback, and then they fill in the blanks around those two people. With Nick Saban, they filled in the blanks around the quarterback position so that the quarterback has never been the focal point of the program. I mean, I think that Nick Saban's philosophy is truly to build a team. He subscribes to the complementary football of offense, defense, special teams tying together. And I think the other thing, too, is, you know, they don't want to be reliant just on a singular player. If your quarterback has an off day, you want to be able to pick up the slack with your special teams or the running game or your defense or what have you. And so I think that they've always tried to take some of the burden off of the quarterback. Obviously, the better the quarterback is, they would love that. But at the same time, the Bama program is not just totally reliant on the play of the quarterback position. They can win a lot of other ways. They've shown and proven that they can do that. I mean, it was really the special teams in the first game against Clemson that won the game for them. The kickoff return by Kenyon Drake, the blocked field goal at the end of the half, you know, and then, of course, the surprise onside kick there early in the fourth quarter. So I think that it's more of just a philosophical thing. I don't necessarily say that they don't try to get the best quarterbacks they can. Obviously, Tua has shown up there, and I think they believe that he has a bright future. So, but again, I think it just the bottom line is that they try to truly build a team concept from the first guy on the team all the way through the 120th kid on the roster.
Well, Phil, we didn't even really get to your other job or your other hat as the Senior Bowl guy. Why don't you just kind of tell people real quick how they can follow your work throughout the season?
Yeah, of course, our website is chock full of info, SeniorBowl.com. People can follow me on Twitter at SeniorBowlPhil. But, you know, we have a watch list of about 400 players. We'll end up seeing probably 300 of those players in person at some point in time over the course of the season. Now, this is a really interesting quarterback class. Friday night, I saw Mason Rudolph, Oklahoma State, was down here in Mobile playing against South Alabama. Of course, Baker Mayfield had a spectacular outing Saturday night. But you got those two guys and then Luke Falk out on the West Coast. And that doesn't even get into the potential juniors that could enter the draft next year. But Josh Allen at Wyoming is a redshirt junior that is expected to graduate in December. So we might be able to get our hands on him. So this is really it's fun to try to sort through all of these players and figure out that the top 110 or so that we can get down here at the end of January and then take it from there. But we had a fun weekend watching Kareem Hunt make his debut for the Chiefs. Of course, he rushed for 100 yards in our game last January after a really solid career at Toledo. So we're proud of seeing those kind of guys. Cooper Kupp, you know, stood out yesterday. Derek Carr's playing well. So our little hashtag is compete and connect. So that's what we try to set up down here in Mobile.
All right. Well, Phil, hey, by the way, just as a postscript on that, Jim Leavitt's going to have quite a perspective, I think, this year after at the end of the season. So he's got – they just saw Tanner Lee. I know you know Tanner pretty well at Nebraska. He's definitely talented, and I think he'll develop. This week, as you know, he's got Josh Allen on the road from Wyoming. Later in the year, they have to play both Washington State, and you get Luke Falk there, and then they got to go on the road to play Josh Rosen and UCLA and also Jake Browning. I know he's not considered quite the same physical talent as some of those other guys, but that's a lot of firepower to see for one defensive coordinator.
I tell you what, that's a full menu for Jim Leavitt and those guys. I guarantee you that. And all of those players present different challenges, and they pose different strengths and weaknesses. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what he has to say.
All right. Well, as always, we appreciate Phil's insight. And the book is Fourth and Goal Every Day, Alabama's Relentless Pursuit of Perfection. If you are a diehard football fan, and if you're listening to this podcast, we'd like to think you are, I would strongly recommend the book just because you're way inside the gold standard of college football programs. And there's just a lot of fascinating detail on how what happens in the war room. And I think that that's just, you know, like it's something you'll start picking at and you'll probably keep reading and reading. And, you know, I think it's a pretty, pretty fun book to get into.
Well, Bruce, I really appreciate it. My wife says, hey, you're a football guy and you wrote a football book. And so I think people get a lot out of it, whether they're an Alabama fan or a college or pro fan. There is a lot of backstory to the book. And I've told some people it's a bit like a Paul Harvey type of thing where now you know the rest of the story.
Yeah. So, and follow Phil on Twitter at Senior Bowl Phil, S-E-N-I-O-R Bowl Phil. Thanks, Phil.
All right, guys. I really appreciate it. You guys continue to have a great season. We'll catch up soon.
Sounds great.
All right. Great to talk to Phil. And we look forward to another great weekend of games this week. Bruce, you're going to Columbus. Are you bringing a flag with you?
I am not. I am bringing Joe Davis and Brady Quinn with me, though. So if we plant them in the field, I don't think Buckeye fans will be any happier about it than they were probably on Saturday night. By the way, were you... did you think that was inappropriate or wrong? I know if you're a Buckeye fan, you probably hated it, but...
I had no problem with it, and I was a little surprised to see Baker apologize on Monday morning. But I guess if you know you're going to be asked about that by reporters, better to apologize than to say, what's the big deal? I don't know, but that's my response. What's the big deal?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, look, I thought, you know, clearly he was irked by Ohio State folks singing on their field, which I didn't think I have an issue with, but you know, this was him one-upping him, and he knows he's never gonna have to go back and play in that stadium again or face Ohio State, so he's getting the last word,
right?
Unless they meet in the playoff, and then we got some fireworks in that one. I wouldn't mind seeing that matchup again.
That'll be great. We will see you guys next time. If you enjoy the Audible, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy college football podcasts, you should also check out the All-American Podcast with Nicole Auerbach, Max Olson, and Chantel Jennings. Our producer on the Audible is Lindsay Fulton. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. Download their music on iTunes and Spotify. Follow Bruce on Twitter at BruceFeldmanCFB. Follow myself at SLMandel. And subscribe to the All-American at theathletic.com/All-American.